I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Eboo Patel, founder of Interfaith Youth Corps, an organization that promotes service and religious pluralism among youth on college campuses. Eboo is a member of President Obama's Advisory Council of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. He is the author of Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation, and Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Jessica. Thank you.
Could you describe the mission of Interfaith Youth Corps?
Our goal is to make interfaith cooperation a social norm. In the same way that multiculturalism has become a social norm and volunteerism has become a social norm and human rights have become a social norm, we want the idea that people from different religious backgrounds come together to build understanding and cooperation to be just part of the water of American life.
What's an example of some of the projects that you focus on?
So one of my favorite stories around this is something that happened at my alma mater, the University of Illinois, over the past, 6 or 7 years. A group of students from U of I interned with us over the summer of, I think it was 2004, and kind of learned our interfaith service methodology. And they went back to Illinois, and they started a group called Interfaith in Action. And every couple of weeks, the kind of core leadership of that group would gather for a shared values discussion, how different religions speak to, say, mercy or compassion or hospitality. And every year they would run a big interfaith service day. That was their big annual event. And they'd get, 150 or so people. The terrible earthquake in Haiti happens a couple years ago. And these students think to themselves, we have to do something big. And they plan this huge event called A Million Meals for Haiti. And they wind up mobilizing 5,000 people to package over a million meals for Haiti. And they have this big discussion board, write your faith or moral inspiration to serve others. And I love that example because it shows how if you do interfaith cooperation or really anything slow and consistent, if you build your leadership group, if you run your annual event, if you start to establish relationships of trust, when a big moment comes, whether it's a tragedy or an opportunity, you can really take off.
Now, you specifically focus on youth. And in your book, Acts of Faith, you talk about how the faces of religious fanaticism are young and the faces of interfaith cooperation are old. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I hate to say this, but religious extremist outfits are really entrepreneurial organizations, and they understand extremely clearly that they have a target segment that they're effectively marketing to, and that's young people. And they use strategies which are really appealing to young people. When we were kind of coming on the scene, given that the segment that we want to mobilize and inspire young people, we had to make sure that we were doing it in ways which were genuinely inspiring and mobilizing to people in their teens and 20s.
You talk about the religious extremist groups being entrepreneurial and brilliant youth organizers. Osama bin Laden wasn't such a bad youth organizer.
Osama bin Laden, that's what he was. He was a youth organizer.
Why has there been a scarcity of that in more cooperative interfaith youth movements?
So, one of the inspiring things for me is that over the course of American history, there hasn't been a scarcity. I think we just don't tell those stories well enough. So think about, Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery in 1955, leading the bus boycott, was 26 years old. And of course, he was drawing on the inspiration of Jesus Christ. He was also drawing on the lessons of Mahatma Gandhi, an Indian Hindu leader. Mm-hmm. And Gandhi, when he started his movement against the racist pass laws in South Africa, was 24 years old.
I want to talk about your own religious journey because, in a way, your personal story deeply informed your professional life and the founding of IYC, or Interfaith Youth Corps. You are Muslim, and your specific sect of Muslim is Ismaili. What does it mean to be an Ismaili Muslim?
Right. So, Ismailis are a small community within the Shia interpretation of Islam. We have a leader who we follow, who we consider kind of the rightful interpreter of the Quran, and that person is the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan has built this really remarkable network called the Aga Khan Development Network, identifying the core values of Islam, mercy, compassion, the dignity of human beings, and building a set of institutions in a dozen plus countries in the Muslim world, you know, where some really bad folks are operating. The Aga Khan Development Network institutions are educating girls and helping small business owners get their businesses off the ground and redoing Muslim monuments and works of art that are kind of falling apart.
So there's this ethos of service within Ismaili Islam, and there's also this emphasis on service even in your own family. Your grandmother, for example, is very service-oriented. Can you discuss that?
Yeah. So, you know, a big part of my faith journey was falling in love with the service heroes of other traditions and all these people across different religions. And at that time in my life, I was probably 20, 21 years old. I never really gave much thought to the tradition of my birth. I just thought it was boring, right? And then the summer before I head off to graduate school, I spend in India, and I spend it at the apartment of my grandmother in the southern part of Bombay. And I wake up one day, and there is this woman in my grandmother's apartment wearing kind of a torn white nightgown several sizes too large for her. So I ask my grandmother, you know, who's this woman? And my grandmother says, well, I don't know her real name. The leader of the local prayer hall brought her here. We'll call her Anissa. Now, don't answer the door for the next few days, because her father and her uncle, who are abusing her, might be looking for her. I said to my grandmother, you know, don't you think you're getting a little bit too old to take in refugee women? And my grandmother gave me this arched eyebrows look, and she padded over to the cabinet, and she brought out this shoebox full of Polaroid pictures, and she opened the shoebox, and here are all these Polaroids of women that my grandmother had taken into her home over 50 years. I said, you know, why did you do this? And she said, well, I'm a Muslim. This is what Muslims do. That was the time in my life when I started to say, I want to live up to this tradition.
It's interesting, you know, your family had a tradition of service, and your great-grandfather, your grandmother's father, started the Ismaili Volunteer Corps in India as well. Your mother also had a deep understanding of pluralism. Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time at the YMCA in leadership activities, and in your book you mention that you come home singing the song Pass It On, and your father was worried because you were getting influenced by other religions, including Christianity. And your mother's response was, you know, I hope they teach the kids Jewish and Hindu songs too. That's the kind of Muslims we want our kids to be. And you mentioned that your mother guessed the arc of your life.
Yeah. My mother guessed the arc, and I would say she pushed me along, and also, you know, and I am grateful to her for that.
Your parents are from India. Your father was an actor and filmmaker in India prior to moving to the United States and working for Leo Burnett, the advertising company.
Right.
And your mother was a CPA, a certified public accountant. What was your own experience as an immigrant child growing up in the Chicago area?
By the time I was in high school, I found this kind of pack of kids who were not like the others in the same way that I was. We were nerdy kids. We not only did well in school, but we liked school. We were from all different religious and ethnic backgrounds. There included a Cuban Jew, a South Indian Hindu, a Nigerian evangelical, a Lutheran, a Mormon, and a Catholic. And what's interesting looking back on that right now is we would talk about literally everything under the sun, but we wouldn't talk about religion. And one of the most formative experience in my life is actually an experience of failure, which is the time, the several months where I watched my Jewish friend experience an ugly strain of anti-Semitism in my high school. And a group of thugs were kind of going after him. And I remember watching this and doing nothing. A couple years later, when we were in college, my friend brings this up with me and says, you know, the hardest part of that was you doing nothing. Mm. Why did you do nothing? And it was a deeply humiliating experience. I shared it with my dad, and my dad was really, really sad about it, really disappointed. And he's like, you know, you failed your friend and you failed your faith. Mm. You failed Islam. If I have taught you anything about religion, it's that Islam, the tradition of the prophets, calls you to stand up for those who are being hurt, especially when they're from a different tradition. That happens when I'm like 18 or 19 years old. And a big part of that moment is me thinking to myself, wow, maybe religion is relevant to me.
Though your relationship to Islam was a complicated one, and you kind of had a moment of clarity in 1998 when you went to visit the Dalai Lama, when you were on the road to creating this interfaith movement, and you, through Buddhist meditation, found Islam again. Can you describe that moment?
Yeah, so, you know, as I look back, and of course, you know, one's history always feels a lot more coherent, and you can connect the dots. They feel linear, and it feels very scattered and confusing when you're going through it. And the moment with my grandmother in her apartment in Bombay was wow, religion. I'm watching this woman be inspired to do dangerous things to help other people in the name of her faith. And then, you know, in that same trip, I had this chance to have an audience with the Dalai Lama. And as you say, you know, I'm kind of practicing Buddhist meditation at the time, and I'm excited to tell the Dalai Lama about my new Buddhist meditation practice. And we get inside the Dalai Lama's receiving room, and he has this conversation with my friend Kevin about Judaism. And then he turns to me and he says, "So you're a Muslim?" And I was like, I was a little confused and taken aback because I was just about to tell him about trying to be a Buddhist. And then he says again, "So you're a Muslim," and I don't say anything. And he describes this time in Tibetan history where one of his predecessor Dalai Lamas has this dialogue with an emerging Muslim community in the city of Lhasa, and the focus of their dialogue is on the shared value between Buddhism and Islam of mercy. And the Dalai Lama says, you know, as we're on our way out, you be a good Muslim, right? And I'm thinking, I'm like, Kevin, how does he know that I'm Muslim? And Kevin's like, well, maybe Dalai Lamas just know things. You know, but those series of moments in my life were hugely important in terms of me looking back at the tradition of Islam, recognizing that there were dimensions of it that were relevant to my life and that were inspiring, and thinking to myself, not only do I want to be a part of this, I want to live up to it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Eboo Patel, founder of Interfaith Youth Corps. We'll hear more from Eboo coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Eboo Patel, founder of Interfaith Youth Corps, an organization that promotes service and religious pluralism among youth on college campuses. He is the author of Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation, and Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. Simultaneous with your own developing allegiance to Islam is your idea for building this interfaith youth corps, which promotes religious pluralism. So people really appreciating their own religion, but working together in the spirit of service. How did that idea first originate?
So, you know, when I was in college, there were two big movements emerging at the time. One was the diversity and multiculturalism movement. This is, you know, 1993. Cornel West has recently published Race Matters. The Rodney King beating had just recently happened. Universities were starting ethnic studies and Afro-American studies departments. You know, the idea of racial and ethnic diversity was pervading the campus, right? And the second movement that was emerging at the time was the service learning movement. So Teach for America was a relatively new organization at that time. City Year was a new organization. President Clinton had just started the Corporation for National and Community Service. And I remember I'd go home, you know, a weekend every couple of months, and I would lecture my dad about multiculturalism and you know, people of color consciousness. And mostly my dad was you know, took this in good humor. And at one point, he got a little frustrated, and he was like, "Listen, the next time you want to lecture me on the consciousness I'm supposed to have as a person of color, you just tell me how we're going to solve the most important diversity problem in the world, and it's about religious diversity. Watch the evening news. Open the morning newspaper. The dimension of diversity driving the world is religious diversity, and you never say a word about it."
And neither did the college campus movements.
It was almost non-existent in the diversity. I can probably count five times, on one hand, the number of times that I heard the word religion in the diversity conversation.
Interfaith Youth Corps was incorporated in 2002 when you got your first grant from the Ford Foundation of $35,000, but the idea had been percolating since 1998. When you had become a Rhodes Scholar and you were doing research on interfaith movements, what were some of the early projects of Interfaith Youth Corps when it was really, not a formal organization
yet? That's a great question, and I got a big smile on my face because those projects were so much fun. We helped to run an Interfaith Habitat for Humanity build in Hyderabad, India, with students from all over the world from different religious backgrounds in an area of Hyderabad that had experienced Hindu-Muslim tension. Just as I saw in college how service brought together people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, the projects that I started doing in graduate school all around the world in India and in South Africa and in different countries in Europe were about bringing young people from different religious backgrounds together around service. And kind of a simple idea occurs to me, which is, what if we built a movement where service was the bridge between young people from different faiths?
In 2002, the Ford Foundation gave you your first grant of $35,000. You, at the time, were not working full-time for Interfaith Youth Corps. You were teaching.
Right.
At what point did you say, okay, this is going to be my full-time work?
Right. So, we got that $35,000 grant from the Ford Foundation in summer 2002. And then we went to a couple of other foundations, the Chicago Community Trust and the Woods Fund, and we basically said, listen, the big boys in New York have invested in this, and we're based right here in Chicago, and most of our projects benefit Chicago. Won't you give us some funding as well? And they did. And as soon as that funding came online in early 2003, I told my wife, will you hold my hand and can we take this leap together? And can I do this full time?
You mentioned your wife, Shanaz.
Right.
She is Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Before you married her, met her, you had a history of dating women of other religions. Your first girlfriend was a Mormon, mm-hmm. and you dated a Jewish woman and a Hindu.
As we come, as we're in a presidential cycle with a Mormon candidate, I find myself thinking a lot about what I learned from my Mormon girlfriend in high school and how much I learned to appreciate her tradition even though I had disagreements with it. And this is part of what we call the science of interfaith cooperation at Interfaith Youth Corps, which is that I view the Mormon community not through the negative things that people are saying about Mitt Romney and the church by proxy. I view the Mormon community through my friendship and my relationship with my girlfriend in high school. And what we know from the social science data in religious diversity is that if you have a positive, meaningful relationship with somebody from a different religion, your attitude towards that whole religious community, and in fact other minority religious communities as well, improves. And it's one of the things that we train our interfaith leaders on college campuses to do through something called the Better Together campaign is we want them to be creating programs where people from different religious backgrounds can develop positive, meaningful relationships.
We mentioned that 2002 was the official founding of the organization. This is after, obviously, September 11th. What role did September 11th play in the organization's development, if any?
Well, the idea occurs to me in 1998. And over the course of my time at Oxford, I, go to different parts of the world and I start interfaith youth projects. And as I'm doing this, I'm thinking to myself, wow, if we had more money, we'd be able to do these projects better and we'd be able to do more of them. So I'd go see foundation program officers and other funder types and, you know, kind of important official types. And I'd tell them the importance of young people as interfaith leaders. And they looked like they wanted to go to sleep a lot. And after September 11th, nobody looked like they wanted to go to sleep anymore.
Do you think Islam has more of an inclination towards extremism than other religions?
No, I think that in the past 40 years, unfortunately, a set of extremist leaders who were able to build strong and entrepreneurial institutions happened to emerge in the world of Islam. But I think it has nothing to do with the tradition. I think it just has something to do with this group of people just happening to emerge. And literally, if you took 8 or 10 people out of the 20th century, Sayyid Qutb, Abdullah Azam, Maududi, Osama bin Laden, Amin Zawahiri, if you took them out of the 20th century, you wouldn't have Muslim extremism. Hmm. It's interesting that this is a show on entrepreneurs and institution builders and the fact that you need people to actually build things. If those people hadn't existed, those institutions wouldn't exist and the movement wouldn't exist.
Some people say that since Islam is inherently a younger religion compared to the other Ibrahimic religions like Judaism, Christianity, there is inherently more strife. It's kind of the religion is going through its adolescence, whereas Christianity has already gone through theirs and Judaism as well. Does that resonate with you?
No. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a sociologist, but I just don't think things fall from the sky or rise from the ground. I think people build things. And that's why we are so intent on building a strong institution mm-hmm. at Interfaith Youth Corps. If we don't build it, then it's not going to exist.
In your book, Acts of Faith, you talk about briefly the founding of Islam. And it was striking to me because the founding of Islam seems to be deeply rooted in religious pluralism. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how Muhammad, when he was giving his first, prophetic calls, he would emphasize that he wasn't creating a new religion, but that he was just trying to return people to God's original message of monotheism and mercy. So it was almost as if he was building on Judaism and Christianity.
It is that he was building on Judaism and Christianity. That's exactly right. And part of what I draw out in Acts of Faith, and even more so in Sacred Ground, is what we call this theology of interfaith cooperation. And I believe that this is deep in every tradition, that you can tell the story of Judaism, the story of Christianity, the story of the Baha'i faith, the story of Hinduism and Buddhism, and certainly the story of Islam as a religion that was highly relational, that sought to build bridges from the beginning.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Eboo Patel, founder of Interfaith Youth Corps, an organization that promotes service and religious pluralism among youth on college campuses. In addition to ultimately raising capital, you built a strong board of directors, one of whom was a director at McKinsey. And in 2009, 2010, your organization kind of had this important pivot moment. Can you discuss that for a moment?
Sure. So I'm smiling because you call it a pivot, and that's so gentle. It felt like a punch in the face. So, the quick story of the organization is once we get our first grant in 2002 and we start running projects and we start running projects that get media attention, and we start getting speaking opportunities across the country, and then the White House and the State Department finds out about us and we start going around the world and talking about interfaith cooperation, it feels like we're going from like celebration to celebration and success to success between 2002 and 2009, 2010. We grow from a $35,000 grant to basically a $3 million budget. We're one of the largest, if not the largest, interfaith organization in the country. When Barack Obama becomes president, he appoints me as one of his faith advisors, which kind of, just signifies the role that we play in interfaith work. So when my friend and board member Tariq Al-Masri says, hey, we ought to do kind of a comprehensive assessment of Interfaith Youth Corps' impact, I'm like, sure, tell us how great we are, just like the press does. I didn't really realize that that's not really how McKinsey consulting engagements go. So I'll never forget Tariq at a barbecue he's having at his house where he invites my wife and family and myself. He kind of lets slip that he's getting the data back and it's unimpressive. Mm. And I think he's speaking Swahili. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, let me be really straight with you, Ibu. You go and speak a lot of places, and people love it when they have an Interfaith Youth Core person there speaking. But when we ask them what they're doing a year or two later, the answer is not that much. And so your medium long-term impact is effectively nil.
When he was telling you this, was there a little kernel of awareness that, that resonates?
Well, when he was telling it to me, I wanted to throw him in the lake. It was an enormously difficult thing to hear. It was the work that you are doing and that you think you're good at is actually not that good. Hmm. And actually, Tariq told me, it's your fault, Ibu. It's your fault because you like to talk about too many things when it comes to interfaith cooperation. You don't define it clearly. You don't articulate a proactive strategy and plan. You know, when somebody asks you a question about interfaith and addiction, you're happy to riff on that for 5 minutes. Or interfaith in the Brazilian rainforest, you're happy to riff on that for 5 minutes instead of saying, here's what we mean by interfaith cooperation, and here's our strategy for accomplishing this, and you can measure our progress.
So concretely, what did that mean? Like, what changes did you make?
So the assessment basically said we had to focus on a target sector and define our goals very clearly. And so it took us, several months and for me weeks worth of sleepless nights to say we're going to focus on college campuses, which means that when U.S. embassies call, we're going to say, sorry, we can't send you a speaker. And when hospitals call and say, can you send us somebody to do a training with our nursing staff, we say no. And when a city calls, we say no. Instead, we work with a single target sector. Instead of running 12 programs with that sector, we effectively run 2 programs with that sector.
And here you were, an international organization at your founding, and you become now a domestic organization focused on college campuses.
That's exactly right. So, and I think about just how hard of a process this was. Look, when Queen Rania wanted to talk to somebody about interfaith cooperation, she called me. When Tony Blair wanted to talk to somebody about interfaith cooperation because he was starting a project, he called me. And of course, that is music to my ego. And it's something that the Interfaith Youth Corps took a lot of pride in. And we start projects with both Queen Rania and Tony Blair and the White House and the State Department and all sorts of outfits. And so what happens is by 2008, 2009, Interfaith Youth Corps is basically a dozen projects. And they're not particularly connected, except they all deal in some way with religious diversity, social action, and young people.
While the impact you were making was not as large as you thought it was, according to this McKinsey study, I wonder, though, if starting off as this hyper-ambitious international organization was almost necessary for you to get the exposure that you got, even if you've now narrowed it down.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that the first stage or two of the organization was very necessary. And if you look at if you read One Day All Children by Wendy Kopp, she tells a similar story of Teach for America being wildly ambitious and starting all kinds of teacher support satellite organizations, et cetera. And we did the same thing. And yes, it did a lot for our profile. It helped us meet a lot of people, which was very, very important. And it helped us get a lot of practice. You know, our people were out in Jordan and they were in South Africa and they were in the Middle East and they were, in Europe running interfaith projects. And we got really, really good at it. But we weren't making a long-term impact. So, we took that veteran team and we said, okay, we now have to discipline ourselves to really make a long-term impact on a key sector.
Your focus is college campuses, which can be divisive communities. How is Interfaith Youth Corps, dealing with that?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. And the name of our campaign is Better Together. There's other people saying we're better apart. There's people saying we're better divided. There's people saying one group is better dominating another group. We at Interfaith Youth Corps are training a critical mass of people who are saying, even if we disagree on hugely important things like abortion or gay marriage or Middle East policy, we know that when we partner on civic projects, we're better together. And we know that that's a huge part of what America is about. So we're going to find ways of having conversations that build bridges instead of barriers.
How have you been able to manage this change in the context of your ego and your own interest in really, you know, answering Queen Rania and Tony Blair when he calls?
That's a really important and kind of an intimate question, and I appreciate it. So I'm in my mid-30s now. I'm not 26 anymore, and I have a wonderful wife, and I have two kids, and I want to be part of building things, and I want Interfaith Youth Core to have a spiritually bigger place on my gravestone than my name. I am not building Eboo Patel.
Right.
I am building Interfaith Youth Core.
That resonates. In your 20s, there is this youthful exuberance.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to use a totally out there parallel, okay. But I heard an interview with the South Park guys, and they said, one of them said, you know, I could never have written South Park. I could never have started it now. And the interviewer was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, there are things you can do in your 20s, mm-hmm. right? Energy that you have, the way you see the world, just like wild craziness mm-hmm. that you're able to just do things. And I think that that's true, right? Mm-hmm. And it is a beautiful thing that I was ready to make a change in my life at the same time that the organization was ready for a new stage. I think I used to view Interfaith Youth Core, interfaith work, as like throwing a set of radical spangles into the world. Throw them as far as they can go and follow them. Follow them to Jordan. Follow them to Kenya. And now I view interfaith work as a craft. Mm-hmm. And my image for that is, you know, a musician in his workshop alone with an acoustic guitar trying to get the timing just right.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thank you for having me, Jessica.
My guest has been Dr. Eboo Patel. Coming up, we'll meet Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber, an on-demand app that allows you to order a car service using your mobile device. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an app-powered car service that helps connect drivers and passengers. The service is available in New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Paris, among other cities. Travis started the company in 2010 with co-founder Garris Camp. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how does Uber work?
You get your iPhone or your Android device out, your smartphone. You push a button, and in 5 minutes, a town car arrives. You can see the car coming to you on the phone, and because you have a credit card on file with us, it truly is like your private driver, because when you get to your destination, you just walk out of the car. Mm-hmm. There's no vouchers. There's no tips already included. It's quite an elegant experience.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, look, in San Francisco, it's very hard to get a cab. The original idea came from my co-founder. Was I just want to push a button and get a car. And he's like, Travis, we should buy 10 Mercedes S-Classes, get 20 drivers, and lease a parking garage. And I said, Garrett, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Now, the pushing the button and getting a car is actually pretty cool. But to be able to do that with just technology without going into owning cars and all that infrastructure was really a more efficient way of doing it.
So you had this idea. How serious was that partnership initially?
When we first got going with the business, it was really very much a lifestyle type thing. And basically the idea was really this would be for maybe 50 of our friends or 100 of our friends. It used to be you had to get a code from me to become to be able to use the service. And you know, my email box started overflowing with people who wanted the special code. So we just opened it up.
Now, the service has been somewhat controversial for a number of reasons, one of which is that you exist outside the medallion system. You have, for instance, New York City mm-hmm. taxis. The drivers work very hard to buy a medallion, which is very valuable. And here you are competing with taxis.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, right, is that what a medallion is it's a license to own and operate a cab. In the city of New York, the number of licenses to own and operate cabs has pretty much been the same since the 1940s. That makes those licenses to own and operate a taxi very valuable. In fact, now they're going for about $1 million apiece. It's very rare to have a driver that actually owns a medallion. These are not millionaires driving cars. What it is that you have investors that own the licenses typically, and they run rental car companies, which we call taxi companies, that rent the car out to taxi drivers at the, you know, the cost. It can be like, you know, as an example, like $200 a shift.
The San Francisco Metro Transit Authority issued a cease and desist order.
That's correct.
What was their issue?
There are a number of concerns they had, but I guess in California, the way it works is that the cities regulate taxis and the state regulates limousines, right? The Public Utilities Commission, the guys who regulate your water and your power, also regulate your limousines. So a cease and desist from the city doesn't have a lot of weight when it comes to a company that, which is Uber, working with a bunch of permitted, licensed limo companies, which are regulated by the state. But the name of our company was Uber Cab, and they said, well, you're marketing yourselves as a taxi company. They have jurisdiction over taxi. And so we took the cab off.
Another part of the controversy surrounding Uber is this dynamic pricing, where as the demand for cars increases, so does the price.
Yeah.
And dynamic pricing exists with hotels and airlines. How did you decide to institute dynamic pricing initially?
Right. Dynamic pricing is what we institute when there's an extreme imbalance between supply and demand. And so everybody knows, let's say in New York, around shift change, like 4 to 5 p.m. or so, all the taxis then do it, you know, then go in and they switch out drivers. So right at the time when everybody needs a taxi is the time when there are no taxis around. And if we don't raise the price, our partners, which are limo companies, will go elsewhere because there is a surge situation. They can make money elsewhere.
Uber has a rating service where the customer rates the driver and vice versa.
Yeah.
What dynamic does that create?
What's interesting about Uber is that we are completely accountable and transparent. So you get a receipt when you're done taking a ride that shows the exact route that was taken, the speed, the distance. And in addition, when you're done with the ride, you rate the driver and the driver rates you. Because of that accountability, all actors in the system act much better. Drivers love it because the riders are acting, you know, civilized, and vice versa.
You have raised capital from a number of venture capitalists, one of which is Benchmark in San Francisco. Can you tell me about that initial encounter?
I had a partners meeting there right after I had a partners meeting with Sequoia. I had an Uber take me to Sand Hill Road and drop me off at Sequoia. And I was just going to hit the button to get the Uber back and take it a mile and a half down the road to Benchmark. I finished my Sequoia meeting, opened up my app, and my Uber wasn't there. I'm stressing out a little bit because I can't go and call Benchmark that I'm going to be late because my system that I'm pitching them isn't working. What I did was I started running. I had my dress shoes on. I had my bag with my laptop, and I started running down Sand Hill Road. And I ran a mile and a half down to Benchmark from Sequoia. Was about 15 minutes late, was sweating, and I'm like, what's going on? They had called my Uber while I was at Sequoia and took it off the system. It was a prank. Anyways, the meeting went really well. This is pretty rare. They put me in a separate room after the partners meeting. They met, you know, they were talked about it for about 15 minutes, and they came in the room and they wanted to do a deal right on the spot. Now, I wasn't really going to let that happen, but the next day I get to my office and there's a box on my desk, and that box was a shoe box, and those guys had bought me running shoes. And so every once in a while I might tweet out or something like that, like I've got my Benchmark shoes on today.
And did they know that you were coming from Sequoia?
They probably did because the car was right outside of Sequoia, so they could open up their app and see the car there.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, an on-demand car service that helps you find a car using your smartphone. You grew up in Los Angeles, and your background is in computer engineering. You went to UCLA. You didn't graduate from there.
Before
starting college, you formed an SAT tutoring company. What were your SAT scores?
Let's just say they're really high. I think I was like 1580.
So did you start this company?
What happened was is I started tutoring SATs in my summer between high school and college. And so it wasn't really a company at that point. But the first person I tutored went up by about 400 points. That's like going from community school to like a UC school, right? That's like a big deal. And pretty soon I was tutoring all the kids on the block, right? At some point, one of the fathers of one of the kids I was tutoring said, let's start a company.
How did you go about getting the clients?
The kid that I was tutoring was Korean background, right? And his family generally was, you know, they went to a Korean church. And so the father, which basically was my business partner, would recruit all of the kids from the Korean church. And so I was the only white guy in the school. And I learned a lot about Korean culture, but it was just kind of an interesting story.
So you were a senior at UCLA when you started your second company called Scour, which was a peer-to-peer search engine technology. Yeah. And that was similar to Napster, which was the music peer-to-peer sharing service, although yours incorporated more multimedia platforms, so video as well. Yeah. How did you come up with that idea?
So actually that was started by a buddy of mine, a guy named Vince Bussum. And so what happened was we would hang out at the Computer Science Undergraduate Association at UCLA, and we would do a few things. We would play Double Dragon. We would do these brain teasers, these like math brain teasers, and we would find MP3s on different FTP servers, and we would download it and play them.
MP3 being these audio files.
That's correct. If you remember way back then, if you're on a Windows 95 machine, you could not, if you had a Windows shared folder and you put files in there, there was no such thing as a firewall. Mm-hmm. Anybody could get it on the internet. So we would crawl Windows shared folders across the internet everywhere. Mm-hmm. We'd index all these files, and we had a website where you'd go type something in, like Britney Spears or Green Day or whatever. And you would get the results, you'd click, and there'd be an application that would help you download these things. The problem is there are only so many sources. There's only so much supply for these files. Mm-hmm. And we got so popular that the demand was outstripping it and therefore crashing the machines that were serving these up. So people's machines would just crash without explanation because too many people were trying to connect to it sort of remotely. Sean Fanning, who is one of our users and the co-founder of Napster, was like, I can do better than this. And so what he did was he made it so that when you went and downloaded a file, that you would automatically share it. What happened in our system, you would get a file and maybe you put it in a Windows share yourself, but he made it where it automatically shared so supply and demand would go up together. And that's why Napster became Napster.
When you realized that Sean had this little innovation,
sure.
What was your reaction?
Well, our reaction was, we're going to do that too. Mm-hmm. So he one-upped us, and then we one-upped him, and it was like this sort of arms race of technology.
Would Sean Fanning tell a compatible story to what you're telling?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, Sean Fanning is an investor in Uber.
So just as Uber has faced a degree of controversy, Scour certainly had a tempestuous start. And part of that conflict came with your early investors, one of whom was Michael Ovitz, the founder of Creative Artist Agency, CAA, and the former president of Disney. What happened there?
So Michael Ovitz did become an investor eventually. Prior to him becoming an investor, we sort of go through the process of getting an investment, which includes a term sheet. And in this case, it was a letter of intent that essentially said we couldn't shop a deal. Now, we were pretty thin on cash, running out of it, so we needed to get a deal done, but the deal just wasn't getting done. So the LOI ran out. We didn't get a deal done. And I had to, we had to go and find money somewhere. But once it was clear that we weren't going to get a deal done with their side, we basically got sued. And that is public knowledge. That was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not really sure how the Wall Street Journal found out about it, but it was published there. And when you get a Wall Street Journal story saying that you've been sued by a guy named Michael Ovitz, you are not going to get funding anywhere. So we had one option, and that was to do the deal with him, and that's what we did.
So you were sued by him because he accused you of shopping the deal, even though the letter of intent had expired.
That's correct.
And the litigation didn't end there because you were also sued by the media companies who said that you were facilitating the stealing of their content through your peer-to-peer file sharing service.
So look, these were the early days. Right now we have sites like YouTube where there's tons of content. It's hosted by YouTube. It's distributed. YouTube was sued by the entertainment industry as well. It's just YouTube had a lot more money to fight that. Mm-hmm. So we got sued over at Scour for $250 billion. At the time, we like to say the GDP of Sweden. And we clearly didn't have that in our back pockets. Mm-hmm. And so we filed Chapter 11 as what we like to say a strategic move. The media industry did not want copyright law to be settled in bankruptcy court in a couple weeks. And so we settled with them for $1 million cash, turned the technology off, and sold the assets of the company for $10 million, which is about what we got in funding.
And what was your psychology at the time? Here you are, you're 22 years old. Did you probably didn't expect to enter this level of turmoil.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was wild days. When you're 22 or 23 and you're going through this, you learn really quickly. But you also just come to accept that's how business is. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that's not how it is.
And then after Scour, you founded Red Swoosh, which was a content delivery network, which had its own share of problems.
Well, here's the thing, right? So we created peer-to-peer technology at Scour. We got sued for it. We went bankrupt, and we had to start over again. So the idea for Red Swoosh was let's take that beautiful technology and take those 33 guys who sued us and turn them into customers with the same stuff they sued us for. When you turn it around and turn them into a customer, you say, look, peer-to-peer is really good at distributing data efficiently at low cost. So I'm going to allow a site, we never worked with YouTube, but here's an example. Imagine going to YouTube, clicking on a link, and watching a video. But instead of that video being distributed over YouTube servers and over YouTube bandwidth, which is quite expensive, it would pull from 30 PCs that had already gotten that video content. And now YouTube, in this hypothetical situation, can save hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
And why was this period so challenging for you at Red Swoosh?
It's like I was 5 years too early to market. I started in like the Dust Bowl of the internet era, right, which was 2001. There's nothing going on. And I did 4 years without a salary. That harshness of basically, I like to say, I got 100 no's a day for 2,000 days straight, which is 200,000 no's, and you keep getting up. I still got customers, but I had to arm wrestle every single one of them to the floor to get them to do it. Mm. And it was just tough.
So now you have Uber, and life seems a bit easier than it was with your former companies. What do you see Uber becoming?
I like to say that FedEx delivers packages tomorrow. Uber delivers packages in 5 minutes. It just so happens that package is a town car that will take you wherever you want to go. But once you're delivering that package of the town car, you can deliver pretty much anything. And so we like to think that we're building an urban logistics fabric, right? A real-time supply chain. And I think that gives some sort of vision for where we think this can go.
Any interesting stories about, passengers or a story with a driver or something like that?
So our community guy in San Francisco, he does all the customer support and a lot of the local marketing in San Francisco. He gets to see everything. I mean, we have a $200 puke charge, for instance. We do suspend accounts. That does happen. When we first do it, we say, look, we hear there was some activity that had occurred, we're going to have to suspend your account. And most of the time people understand and they move on. Sometimes people go, it was a perfectly fine ride. I don't know what you're talking about. And then you respond by saying, well, there was some, you know, there was some word that you had done a drug deal and were attempting to solicit a prostitute while in one of our partner's cars.
And then
they usually don't say anything else.
So here you are, you are a car service and a law enforcement service.
Yeah, we definitely don't think of ourselves that way, but there, you know, all the things that happen in the real world, you know, this is a transportation system. These types of things can happen. And so we have to just act, you know, responsibly in those situations.
So you have a $200 charge for people vomiting in your taxi. What about women breaking their water? I was rushing to the hospital to give birth to my first daughter, and my water broke in the taxi.
So there have been a number of Uber babies. And people tweet about it quite often. So a number of times where drivers have, you know, taken a woman in labor to the hospital. We've never had a baby born in an Uber. That would be a beautiful thing in my book. We would not charge the customer for that situation, but we may compensate the driver.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been Travis Kalanick, co-founder of Uber. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.